Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. You're listening Post for Politics, Iowa style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We're glad you're with us as always. I'm Dennis Hart, joined also as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we go again. Welcome.
Oh, good to be with you, Dennis.
Let's talk fast. Well, not fast, but quickly, because we have so much to talk about tonight in the state legislature. Last week and then today, Monday, the logjam that had been holding up action broke, at least partly, moving lawmakers closer to finishing their work for this session, but they are still not done. Let's talk about today, Monday, as we go live on Monday night. The state Senate passed a bill on a party line vote, of course, Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed, letting families receiving child care from the state aid choose to make additional private payments to their providers. What does this mean?
Well, the child care assistance program in Iowa really affects very low-income families. So, for instance, up to about $33,000 annual income for a family of three. And one of the issues is that some child care centers don't accept this program because what the state pays doesn't really cover the full wage. So this bill would give families the option to pay more that would supplement the wages of people in those centers. And the idea, I think, is to get more child care centers accepting families who use this program. But the thing is, the families who need child care assistance typically don't have the disposable income to be spending that much extra. So in the past, there have been some child care bills that have passed, and particularly in the Iowa House in recent years, there were some bills with bipartisan support. But this year, it seems like the only child care bills that are headed to the governor's desk have been passed on party line votes, and with the Democrats saying that it doesn't address the core issue, which is that there's a shortage because workers aren't paid enough.
About how many families do we think might be affected by the bill passed today?
Well, it's really hard to say because, again, I mean, in theory, there could be thousands of families affected, but the likelihood that many families would be able to pay $100 a week extra, for instance, is just, it doesn't seem that it will affect very many people. It's hard to estimate how many people will take advantage of a new program. But I do think that it's very likely the governor will sign this bill and the child care bills that that passed last week, because that will allow her to campaign on the fact that she addressed one component of the workforce shortage, even if Democrats don't think that these are real solutions to the child care problems.
That vote you talked about last week involved a bill that's going to let 16-year-olds work alone in child care centers and would let adult staff members care for more kids at those facilities.
Yes, so there are a few components to it. As you said, 16-year-olds, they would be able to watch school-age children without supervision. I mean, one issue is that 16-year-olds tend to be in school during the hours that most people need child care. So, but this would be, they would presumably be working in more like before and after care settings. The other part of the bill, as you mentioned, would allow a staff members, one person could supervise 7 2-year-olds or 10 3-year-olds. That would be an increase compared to the current law. And those were the reasons that the Democrats voted against it. There was a Democratic amendment had been offered to that bill in the Senate saying if child care centers are going to lower the age of staff or increase the staff to child ratios, they should at least inform parents that that's happening. And that amendment was voted down along party lines. So parents may not even become aware that suddenly one person at the child care center they've been using for a long time will be supervising 10 3-year-olds instead of a 7 or 8.
One of the big ones the legislature passed last week, a bill requiring most gas stations to offer gasoline with higher blends of ethanol at the pump in Iowa. We've been talking about this a long time. It's E15. This would start in 2026. And this is the governor supports this. She's likely going to sign it. This is a big one.
Yes. I mean, this was viewed as a compromise, somewhat of a compromise. The gas stations, the retailers were still registered against the bill. But this is the bill we talked about in February. It passed the Iowa House with strong bipartisan support. And then it sailed through the Senate Agriculture Committee. And then it landed in the Ways and Means Committee, which has jurisdiction over taxes. And it just sat there for 2 months. So that's where the backroom negotiations were happening between staff in the governor's office, state lawmakers, people representing representing the agriculture interests that really wanted the bill and people representing gas stations. So the new amendment to the bill that was unveiled last week would create more exemptions for smaller gas stations. Also, there would be state grants so that they might receive up to 90% of the cost of retrofitting their gas stations, or they could opt out. Now, there were still people critical of the bill saying it's going to put smaller gas stations at a competitive disadvantage, because if they don't offer E15 and a nearby station that's part of a large chain does, then people will drive there for the cheaper gas. So in any case, I think that there were still on the retailer side, there were still people unhappy with the bill, but it did end up passing with strong bipartisan support in both chambers. And of course, the governor issued a statement right away saying that she was planning to sign the bill.
And after the legislature passed that last week, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency issued a temporary waiver letting gas stations sell E15. And this, of course, came after the president had come to Iowa and said he wanted to do that.
Yes. And I mean, most gas stations that sell E15 are located in the Midwest. Only about 2% or so of gas stations across the country are equipped to sell this. And in most other states where the corn growers are not a big lobby group, or the biofuels industry are not a big lobby group, you're not going to be seeing laws like this in any other places. So I don't know how many gas stations outside Iowa are really going to be selling E15, but this should somewhat increase demand. I mean, Dave Swenson, who's an economist at Iowa State University, he was on a podcast, the We All Want Clean Water podcast, last week. And he was saying most Iowans already buy ethanol, the 10% blend. So to have people have it, the 15% blend be available, it might not increase usage as much as you'd think, because most people are already buying gas with ethanol. So we'll see what happens. But this is something certainly the governor is going to declare this as a win. It's something she's talked about. She tried to get it through last year and it didn't get through last year. So this is a legislative victory for her.
It was an interesting piece in the Register this past weekend, and a commentary from someone who said, yeah, this is going to benefit E15, going to benefit farmers and ethanol producers and others, of course. But, you know, long term, it's going to harm the environment and we ought to cut back on corn production in Iowa. That seems like an argument that is like blowing in the wind. It ain't going anywhere.
Right. I mean, there was a big study released. University of Wisconsin researchers were involved with it earlier this year that said that the ethanol production, to include all of the inputs, the corn growing and everything else, that it doesn't help in terms of reducing greenhouse gases. It might actually have more greenhouse gas emissions compared to just conventional gasoline. And so there are environmental voices who are very unhappy about this. But right now, I mean, there's strong bipartisan support in Iowa for anything that helps ethanol plants. I mean, long term, I don't know what the future of ethanol plants are, but Iowa politicians of both parties are going to be falling all over each other to demonstrate that they are trying to support the industry as much as they can.
Falling all over each other as if in a kabuki theater production.
Possibly. Well, this yes. is, I think this is real. This is just pretending to support ethanol. This is actually supporting ethanol industry. So
this a reference to something. Kabuki theater. This a reference to something Laura said last week. First time we'd ever used the term kabuki theater on this broadcast, but certainly not the last. Okay. Also last week, House and Senate Republicans gave final passage to that proposal to cut jobless benefits. 10 weeks earlier, jobless benefits used to last 26 weeks. They're going to last now 16 weeks. Democrats opposed it, but they were powerless to stop it.
Yeah, so this was the bill that passed both houses, both chambers in March, passed different versions of the bill that agreed on most things. So the cutting of the benefits, the maximum benefits in any one year from 26 weeks to 16 weeks. Most states around the country do offer up to 26 weeks of unemployment. So this puts Iowa a bit out of step with other states. There were other aspects of the bill, so changing the definition of misconduct so that some people might not be able to collect unemployment at all. But the sticking point was that the Senate wanted to impose a one-week waiting period on whether people could start collecting unemployment, and the House Republicans didn't vote for that. So the cutting from 26 weeks to 10 weeks, that's expected to reduce payments from Iowa's unemployment trust fund by about $70 million a year. And that imposing a one-week waiting period would have taken another $23 or $24 million out of jobless Iowans' pockets. So what ended up happening was the Senate just capitulated. They said, we're going to go ahead and pass the House bill. And that's what they did. So yeah, I saw it as some kind of an olive branch, maybe, to try to get the Senate, of course, is still very committed to trying to get the House to pass some form of this education voucher bill. And it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere.
Let's talk about that. What still needs to be resolved in the legislature. We should explain that the legislature is in overtime now. Their per diems have been cut off. They hope to adjourn by April 19th. They are not. And the big one appears to be the crippler, if you will, private school tuition assistance. You say it appears to be going nowhere. So how does this resolve itself?
I'm still hearing from people that there are at least 20 votes in the House Republican caucus against this. They have 60 members in the 100-person House, so they can only afford to lose 9 people on any bill that doesn't have Democratic support, like this one, the education student savings accounts, or whatever you want to call it. It's basically vouchers that would take some public school funding and divert it to private schools. So one scenario that I've heard talked about just in the last few days is that House leaders might just bring this to the floor later this week, knowing they don't have the votes, let the chips fall, call people's bluff, see who's actually willing to go and vote against the governor's agenda on the floor, which might be different from saying in a private closed door caucus, I'm against the bill. We'll see how many people actually vote against it. And then if the bill fails, they can say to the Senate, look, we had a vote on it, and see if the Senate moves the budget bills. That is a scenario I've heard. And if that happens, then the legislative session might be ready to wrap up by the end of next week. So around May 12th. I mean, they still don't have agreement on the budget targets. That's the other thing. I mean, even if the Senate decides not to insist on the school vouchers as a condition of moving forward budget bills, they still have some ground to make up on those before they can send to the governor. And another angle that I don't think we talked about before is that political action committees and lobbyists are not allowed to donate to state legislators while the legislature is in session. And there are a dozen or more House Republicans who are in competitive primaries right now. And so the longer this session goes on, it means that lobbyists and PACs that tend to support incumbent members of the legislature can't cut those checks before the June 7th primary.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting point, because the primary itself, as you point out, is 5 weeks away. And it's getting almost no ink because the legislature is still blockaded here. And that's a problem for every candidate.
It really is. It's a problem for all of them, but particularly the ones who are facing primaries. And those tend to be more common in years after redistricting because the map has scrambled everything. So there are incumbents thrown in together. There are a number of challengers. Some of the challengers have support from political action committees, and the challengers can get money. If you're not an incumbent, you can get money from special interests right now, but the incumbent legislators can't accept those checks until the legislature has adjourned for the year. So it's tricky. And usually in election years, the legislatures, they like to clear out early. They like to finish their work and get out of town. But obviously, that's not happening now.
Right. Tell me about the favorite bill that I keep bringing up week after week here, the bottle bill. Will there be a bottle bill? Will we have any action on this?
Dennis, honestly, I have not heard one person talk about the bottle bill. I've been talking to my legislative sources since the last time we talked last Monday for our show. I just don't know. It may be in the mix within these backroom negotiations, but I don't hear people talking about it. I really hear primarily that something has to be done on education. I mean, some kind of education bill needs to get to the governor's desk, and they need to pass a budget. And there are other policy bills that may end up getting folded into these appropriations bills, but I don't know which ones they are. I haven't heard of anybody talking about the bottle bill.
It's enough to make one want to go get a bottle. It's 14 after the hour. Wherever you're listening to us, with or without a bottle, you are in tune with KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellenberg, here every week at this time to talk about politics Iowa style and how it's affecting all of us. Okay, let's talk about an event that took place last week. 3 Republicans running for Congress in Iowa's 3rd District were at a forum last week, and they all expressed their indignation and frustration at the prosecution of Americans for crimes committed on January 6th last year at the U.S. Capitol, each of them seemingly trying to outdo the other in terms of denigrating prosecutions and defending the folks who went into the Capitol. That was a very interesting forum.
It was. So the three candidates, just to remind everyone, there's State Senator Zach Nunn. He has been in the legislature for about 10 years, and he has the endorsement of the National Republican Congressional Committee. There's a businesswoman, Nicole Hasso, who's a first-time candidate. Very few people had heard of her before she announced last summer that she was running in this primary. And she also, this is unusual, she also has the endorsement of the National Republican Campaign Committee. And they've both raised a fair amount of money, Zach Nunn more. And then Gary Loeffler, who's better known as the Trump tractor guy, you've probably seen his picture if you've seen coverage of any Republican event in the last 5 years or so. He goes all over the state in this highly decorated Trump tractor. And Gary Loeffler actually was at the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th, and he was in a group that walked over to the Capitol building. He actually posted a picture on his social media of himself standing near the Capitol building, but he did not enter the Capitol building. So he has not, he said that his wife was very glad that he didn't enter the Capitol building. So he wasn't charged. But in any case, as you said, they were at the Westside Conservative Club in Urbandale. It's a big monthly event that attracts a lot of Republicans in the Des Moines area. And Zach Nunn was the first to answer this question, and he said that he was upset about this, and he said, you know, a year and a half later, he criticized the House committee that's investigating January 6th, and he said that they haven't charged anyone, which actually isn't true. Prosecutors have charged more than 750 people, as the Des Moines Register reported. So there have been a lot of prosecutions. But in any case, Nicole Hasso was also very critical of the idea. And Gary Loeffler, as I mentioned, he stressed that he didn't go into the building. But he said that the narrative is wrong, that the police actually opened the doors and let people come inside, and that he made it sound like it wasn't a violent storming of the Capitol. So he doesn't think, and Nicole Hasso also doesn't think that the people did anything wrong, at least she said at this forum. So, I mean, it does seem to be a litmus test now a bit in the Republican Party that to demonstrate a loyalty to Donald Trump. And this is part of that. And I should say also that Zach Nunn, not only did he not support Donald Trump before the 2016 Iowa caucuses, he endorsed Jeb Bush, who was so really from a very different wing of the Republican Party. But right now, they're all competing for that same niche of that Donald Trump Republican.
Nicole Hasso said there is no support, no evidence that any of those people arrested had done anything wrong. So let's set the record straight. 249 people have pleaded guilty in connection with this. 150 have been sentenced. Three have been convicted at trial. So I don't know how she gets to say that.
Well, and there was a lot of property destroyed, and there were Capitol Police who were injured, some of them severely injured. So, I mean, clearly there were crimes committed. And as you mentioned, many of the people have pled guilty already, and some others are facing trial. So, I mean, it was a strange thing to say, but there's this alternative narrative. And even, I mean, last year, immediately after the storming of the Capitol last year, you saw this on some conservative social media. There was a combination of if anything bad happened, it was Antifa infiltrators who did it, versus also people taking that position. Well, nothing bad really happened, and the media distorted that, and some of the footage that you saw just, you know, wasn't true. So there's a big, obviously within the Republican Party, the consensus view is to try to discredit the House committee that Nancy Pelosi appointed to investigate the January 6th events. And they're going to be holding hearings in the coming months, but I don't think that's going to make any difference within a Republican, certainly not in a Republican primary challenge. And it's hard to know whether that'll break through to affect anyone in the general election.
Meanwhile, this past Saturday night, the Iowa Democratic Party held its annual Liberty and Justice Celebration, a hoo-ha, and you wrote that the party's statewide candidates deserved better. What do you mean?
Well, I should say, first of all, I watched this event by the live stream because of my broken ankle from a few months ago.
Yes.
I didn't think I could make the long trek from wherever I'd have to park to the Iowa
But excuses.
There were about 450 to 500 people there. So this is one of the largest Democratic events of the year, and by far the largest event before this primary that's coming up on June 7th. And they gave speaking time to all three of the candidates for U.S. Senate, Deidre DeGeer, who is the only Democratic candidate for governor, and also each of the four Democrats running in the U.S. House districts. But the three incumbents who hold statewide offices, that would be Attorney General Tom Miller, State Treasurer Mike Fitzgerald, and State Auditor Rob Sand, they didn't get speaking time. They were in a very short video, less than a 3-minute video that was almost like more of a comedy sketch than a political speech. And then the three non-incumbent candidates for statewide office, that would be John Norwood, who's running for Secretary of Agriculture, and Joel Miller and Eric Van Lanker, who are running for Secretary of State. They also were relegated to a video that was, it was sort of a Q&A, and it had some dad jokes in there, and it was about 5 minutes long, but it didn't really give you a lot of information. If you were someone trying to decide who I should support in the Secretary of State primary, it wouldn't really give you a lot of useful information. And in fact, after I published something on my website to say that I thought that these candidates deserved a chance to speak directly to this audience of very plugged in activists who are going to go home to their communities and potentially influence a lot of other Democratic activists, Joel Miller, who is the Linn County Auditor and one of those Secretary of State candidates, he commented on Twitter that actually that video was a compromise, that originally the Iowa Democratic Party wasn't even going to give them any visibility at all during this event, which I found quite shocking. So I felt that the statewide offices are important. I think that Democrats probably might be a little bit complacent about Tom Miller and Mike Fitzgerald because they've been in office for so long. But this is looking like it's probably going to be a Republican year. It typically is a good year for the party that's not in power in Washington. And so I think that those candidates and State Auditor Rob Sand, who's just finishing up his first term, I think that they should have had a chance to talk to the crowd about what's important in their races and how people can get involved.
And briefly, what contrast did you see in the speeches among the three Democrats running for the U.S. Senate nomination for Republican Chuck Grassley seat, Finkenauer, yeah, Franken, and Hurst?
Yeah, so I'm going to go in the order that they were allowed to speak, and I think this was determined by random drawing on the evening. So Mike Franken, retired vice admiral, spoke first, and it was, I don't want to say technocratic, but it was a fairly subdued speech. If you've ever seen him speak, he's a little bit of a cerebral speaker. He's not a longtime politician. And he talked a lot about growing up and how when he grew up on a farm, when he worked in a slaughterhouse, when he was in the Navy, that people didn't really talk about politics and political differences. And that now there's so much more division. And he talked about reaching out to Republicans, reasonable Republicans. He talked about when he worked for Senator Ted Kennedy for a couple of years, he was on his staff. Even though Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, of course, was very progressive, he was also working with Republicans every day on some issues where they could find common ground. So he talked about his experience, his military experience, and also his ability to reach across the aisle and communicate with people who might not consider themselves Democrats. So that was his approach. Abby Finkenauer spoke a little bit later in the program. She gave a very sort of fired up speech talking about democracy. Mike Franken talked about democracy, but she talked about it at a little bit of a higher level of that Republicans are attacking democracy. And she was a first term. She only served one term in the U.S. House. And she talked about how Republicans came after her. She talked a little bit about her accomplishments in the U.S. House, but really mainly she talked about taking the fight to Chuck Grassley. And then the third speaker later in the evening, Dr. Glenn Hurst, I would say that his demeanor was more one of like a happy warrior. He had a lot of jokes woven in through his speech. He was talking about Chuck Grassley. He talked about being endorsed by some progressive organizations. He's raised much, much less money than either of the other two candidates, but he talked about being endorsed by Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Action Fund and Our Revolution, which is the people who were formerly involved with Bernie Sanders' campaign. And so he was going for, like I said, the happy warrior that, and we can win this. And he also spoke about some of the accomplishments of Senator Tom Harkin, who of course was the last Democrat to win a U.S. Senate race in Iowa in 2008 when he was reelected for the last time. So he talked about that and said progressives can win in Iowa, and Tom Harkin proved that.
Let me just mention this, and then we'll move on to another topic. The two televised debates have been confirmed for the Democratic U.S. Senate primary in Iowa. Your chance to see these candidates and what they stand for and how they appear. First one is this coming Saturday night at 7 o'clock on KCCI-TV in Des Moines and several other stations around the state, but the closest one for us is KCCI. That's 7 this Saturday night on Channel 8. And then Thursday, May 19th, the second debate taking place at 7 o'clock on Iowa PBS. Check your local listings, as everybody says. All right, you reported also that Iowa Democratic State Senator Janet Peterson had alleged last week that the state's Human Resources Agency is not releasing certain statistics on pending sexual harassment complaints. So this is quite interesting. What do you make of this?
Well, it was a surprise for me. I was interested in the Senate confirmation of the Department of Administrative Services Director Adam Steen, because last year the Democrats withheld their support and he wasn't confirmed. And the governor ended up leaving him in that position. And so there was some pressure and question about whether he would get confirmed this year. And so when I saw last week that he had been confirmed unanimously, I thought, oh, that was interesting. I wonder why the Democrats did that. And then when I went and watched the video of the debate, Senator Janet Peterson, she stood up and right away she said she was going to be supporting Adam Steen's confirmation. But then she talked about how she was not happy with the Department of Administrative Services, and she's been trying to get information about sexual harassment complaints pending. And all she could get from the agency was aggregate information. So they said they have 199 pending cases. But when she asked how many of those are hostile work environment versus sexual harassment, how many of them or other kinds of discrimination, how many of them are related to people who are merit employees versus employees covered by a union contract, and how many of them are people who are appointed by the governor, and the agency wouldn't break down any of that information. And so she said, you know, this is problematic for a couple of reasons. First of all, senators are asked to vote on confirming the governor's appointees, and they may not know whether any of them have been the subject of an investigation related to the workplace environment. But also, she said, she wasn't even sure whether the governor's office is informed if one of the governor's appointees who's running an agency is accused of sexual harassment or fostering a hostile work environment. And I did this morning, I asked the Department of Administrative Services, they haven't responded yet, what is their procedure if someone appointed by the governor were investigated? Is that something that routinely would be passed along to the governor's office? I would think that it would be, but I haven't gotten any confirmation of that.
Okay, we have less than 3 minutes, so very quickly, three Iowans were among the first to have their sentences commuted by President Biden last week, sentences for people who have been convicted of nonviolent federal drug offenses, three Iowans.
Yeah, so there were 75 federal prisoners around the country who had committed nonviolent drug offenses, and three of them, as you mentioned, were in Iowa. The president also issued his first pardons, and this was as part of April, the Second Chance Month, and his administration rolled out a lot of other initiatives to try to support people who are finishing their sentences and trying to get back into society, because, of course, if people have access to education or a job, they're much less likely to reoffend.
You reported today, moving on, that more than 4 months from the usual publication date of December 31st, the state's annual comprehensive financial report that ended last June is still nowhere to be seen. So why is that important?
Well, this is a report that it's the foundation for a lot of other audits that come later. So it's required by law. The state has to do this for decades. They routinely got this report published by December 31st. Last year, as I think we talked about on the show, the report it ended up being 9 months late. And the main sticking point last year was accounting problems at Iowa State University. They had shifted over to the Workday computer system for accounting at the beginning of the 2020 fiscal year, and it created all these problems in compiling their year-end data. But ISU has told me that they submitted all of their data by last November, and that is not the reason why this report is so delayed. So I can't get an answer from the Iowa Department of Administrative Services on what exactly is going on over there. And the only notice that was posted on a national website that is the main source of information for people who invest in municipal bonds, they put in a notice in January that said that the report was not posted on time due to circumstances associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. And I thought that was curious. I'm not really sure how the pandemic would be affecting compiling financial data for the state's report. So I haven't been able to get any information on that. But that delay is going to lead to more delays as the state auditors try to complete their work later in the year, when they have to publish other financial audits of all the many different entities and pieces of state government.
And in 20 seconds, what's your crystal ball telling you about what to expect in the legislature this week?
Well, I'm very interested to see if they call people's bluff and bring this voucher bill to the floor in the House. And then if that happens, whether the logjam breaks and we do start to see more movement on the budget starting this weekend and going into next week.
And quickly, it's fair to say lawmakers really want to get out of there.
They do. I mean, they definitely do. So the question is, who's going to, I think the Iowa Senate is going to have to somehow back down, because I just don't think the votes are there in the House to pass this voucher bill.
And we are out of time. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week when we'll have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. We hope you can join us. In the meantime, we also hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.